reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. We're delighted to have, is it Loyal or Loyal?
Loyal.
Loyal. Loyal School District students. I asked the last time and couldn't remember the answer. Would you please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a Court with Class program that the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin sponsor. Students from high schools across the state, middle schools, are invited to attend an oral argument. And if the school accepts that invitation, we send them briefs, and they may do some work on this case. And in addition to coming and doing some work, they are also invited to a noon presentation by a justice, at which time the process will be discussed, not the substantive issues of this case. We're very proud of this program. It's a national award-winning program and has been copied by many states. So let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and he's the justice with whom you'll meet at noon. And to his right is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, we'll now call our second case, 2003 AP 2628, Racine Harley Davidson versus State of Wisconsin Division of Hearings and Appeals. Arguing for Racine Harley Davidson is Sarah A. Zylstra. And she will do it for 15 minutes, arguing on behalf of WATDA. The amicus is Brian E. Butler. He will have 10 minutes. Mr. Stone will argue for Harley Davidson for 30 minutes, and then Ms. Zylstra will have 5 minutes rebuttal. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you. You may proceed, Ms. Zylstra.
May it please the court and counsel. I am Sarah Zylstra, and I represent Racine Harley Davidson, Inc., which is a motorcycle dealer in Racine, Wisconsin. Given the possible confusion with names, I will refer to my client as Racine and Harley Davidson as Harley Davidson. We're here today for two reasons. One is because the Court of Appeals decision is a significant expansion of current law on the standard of review. And that decision not only has a negative impact on this case and on every manufacturer dealer case, but almost every case in front of an administrative agency. The second reason we're here today is because the administrative agency's decision in this case effectively eviscerates the dealer protections provided by the legislature in Chapter 218. Now, I can't know which issue caught this court's attention. I will address.
The court has that problem.
I will address both, but I am happy to focus my efforts on one issue or the other if the court so requires.
Let me just ask this. As I read these briefs, and many times, and this may be one of those times, the amount of deference you give to either the trial court or the administrative agency might really decide the case. Might. Doesn't necessarily, but might. And that seems to be a big dispute between the parties or among the parties as to the amount of deference. And here's what bothered me, and I sort of picked this up quite late in my study of this case. and did not go back and reread the various cases we had on great weight to de novo deference. And it's this. At least my understanding is that several years ago, each department, administrative agency, had its own staff that reviewed its decisions, right? In the staff, in the agency. And then at some time, we got a division of hearings and appeals in the Department of Administration. And the Department of Transportation is reviewed by the Division of Hearing and Appeals. But as best I can tell from this record, the Department of Transportation, is the Department of Transportation we're dealing with? Is that the main department?
Correct.
Okay. They never made a decision in this case.
The way the process works now, in my understanding of it, is that the division has the supervisory or the regulatory oversight over administrative agency disputes under Chapter 218.
Right.
The particular administrative law judge in this case, Mark Kaiser, was reviewed, and there is...
Where does Mr. Kaiser sit? According to the appendix, he sits in the division of hearings and appeals in the Department of Administration. Is that right?
That's correct, although I cannot vouch for where he is sitting currently.
I understand that. But when I read the statute, it says that they're going to rotate the hearing examiners. So what my point is, in the old days, you had hearing examiners and you had departments make decisions on the basis of their expertise in that area. Now, I have no idea whether Mr. Kaiser is an expert on Department of Transportation issues or whether he is not. And I have no idea whether Mr. Schwartz, who reviewed Mr. Kaiser, who also sits in the Division of Hearings and Appeals, is an expert. I mean, the reason you give deference is because the department is supposed to be the expert and has authority, whereas the Department of Transportation has, as best I can see, nothing to do with this case.
With all due respect, Your Honor, it would be in my interest to completely agree with you.
I understand.
Unfortunately, I don't feel like I can do that and be honest to this court in doing so. The administrative law judge, Mark Kaiser, in this case, has reviewed many cases in his capacity as an ALJ involving Chapter 218. And if you do a search, you will find Mark Kaiser as the administrative law judge on cases involving manufacturer and dealer disputes.
Is that a peculiarity to this case, or is that general that some of these people get assigned to specialties, or don't you know?
I'm not entirely certain. Unfortunately, I wasn't practicing law in the days before the division, and
okay.
So I'm a little unclear as to the prior precedent involving the division.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
As I mentioned, there are two issues. One is the standard of review, and one is the merits. Both issues require reversal, but from Racine's perspective, either will do. I'm going to start with the standard of review because I think that is a very significant issue for this court. It comes down to a simple question, which is whether the Court of Appeals is correct that just because an administrative agency administers the statutory scheme or a particular chapter, that great weight deference is owed. And I think the court ought to think about that in terms of this. The decision represents both a significant and a novel delegation of this court's authority, and it's delegating that authority to the executive branch. That dramatic delegation ought to give this court pause. There was a reason for the court established deference in terms of with respect to administrative agencies. There's a public policy there that's not being furthered by the Court of Appeals decision. Both Harley-Davidson concedes this. Everyone concedes this. The division was presented an issue of first impression. There was no prior track record that was at all connected with what is included in a dealer agreement for purposes of 218.0116 sub 8. And the division has never interpreted 18.0116(8) under any set of facts.
Counsel, I have a little different question about the standard of review for you. The statute talks about the agreement or the contract between the dealer and the manufacturer. Don't we have to use plain old contract principles to decide what that contract is, and why is there any deference under any standard in regard to that question of what the contract includes?
That is exactly a point that was made in the briefs. There are actually two reasons why great weight deference is not owed. One is it's an issue of first impression, which everyone concedes and no one disputes. But the second is the fact that this case doesn't really involve a statutory construction per se. It involves contract construction. And the division is not an expert and doesn't have technical expertise in contract law and contract construction. Courts do. Courts do it all the time, and that's why great weight deference is not owed, and de novo review is the appropriate standard of review to apply to this case.
Well, counsel, if I could follow up on Justice Rogensack's question. In looking at 218.0101(1A), defining agreement, agreement means a contract that describes the franchise relationship between manufacturers, distributors, importers, and dealers. It would seem that, and correct me if I'm wrong, that we're dealing with a kind of a hybrid here. On the one hand, you're dealing with the interpretation of a statute defining agreement. Right within that statute, you have the description of a contract that does something else. And so I guess my question to follow up Justice Rogensack is, when we're looking at what constitutes the contract, should we be utilizing de novo review? But when we look at how the statute should be interpreted, we go elsewhere.
Well, in this case, you don't have to grapple with the tough question. And that's because even if you accept the principle that this is a statutory construction case, it's still de novo review because it's an issue of first impression. So with respect to your question, you get there either way you go. Now, I'm sorry, Justice.
Please.
That being said, in my personal opinion, I think it's more of a contract issue rather than a statutory interpretation issue.
And if I could follow up, I would expect that your learned opponent would argue that, well, wait a minute, we have some experience in interpreting Chapter 218, and even though we may not have specifically dealt with this specific section of these statutes, we're entitled to some deference here. Even if we don't get to great weight, we're entitled to some deference
that
in terms of how the contract should be viewed in relationship to the franchise relationship between manufacturers, distributors, importers, and dealers.
That is incorrect under this Court's current precedent and longstanding rules on when deference is owed and why deference is owed. If we look solely at 218, if the justices have not looked at that chapter, I suggest you do. However, I suggest you're close to a bed when you get there because it is long, it is dry, it is complicated. The statute itself spans so many pages in the statute books, it's unbelievable. 218.0116(8) itself spans five pages. Just one single section of that statute spans five pages. So if we are going to operate under the principle that having experience with 218 makes an administrative law judge some sort of expert, well, I'd be impressed because I've had a fair amount of experience with 218 and I will never call myself an expert on that chapter.
Counsel? I remember a few years ago when Justice Steinmetz wrote this opinion called UFE versus Lurk, and that was on the heels of another opinion he wrote, the Harnischweiger case. And Harnischweiger and UFE are often cited as precedents for this deference stuff because he took the time, at least in UFE, to go through it. And there are other cases, too, but those are two that show up even here today. At any rate, due weight deference, he describes in UFE, thus, the deference allowed an administrative agency under due weight is not so much based upon its knowledge or skill as it is on the fact that the legislature has charged the agency with the enforcement of the statute in question. That's his rendition. It's been cited with approval several times since then. And as I understand that anyway, even if the agency hasn't had lots of experience, or maybe even any experience with a specific provision, that if the administrative agency has been charged by the legislature with the enforcement of the statute or provision in question, then the court gives due weight. How do you respond to that, counsel?
The problem with that interpretation, if it is applied broadly, as in the context of saying, because I have some familiarity with 218, I get at least due weight deference, is you got to think, when does de novo apply? I apologize. You're effectively eliminating de novo review, except in the rare case where an agency is considering an issue that's entirely outside of its authority. That in of itself is probably something that's going to be a jurisdictional problem. There were three levels of deference created for a reason. If you get rid of de novo, you're changing the current state of the law, and you're also changing the policy as to when you defer and why you defer.
What's the agency here?
The division?
Is that your response?
It is without a particular question attached to that. The division is the administrative agency that ruled on these issues and that...
I know. That's what's key. Why is that any different than a trial court who rules on a statute? The decision that Justice Bradley referred to in Lurk made the decision. Lurk made the decision.
I mean, you're...
And now what you have is an administrative law judge, like a trial court judge, interpreting the contract and the statute. Department of Transportation, which is charged with this administration, has said nothing.
I agree with you, Your Honor, that it certainly presents an opportunity. If this Court wishes to change or perhaps focus its current law on the standard of review to make it clear that when an agency is the responsible party, it would give deference, but when it is a division, it would not.
I'm going to check the cases to see if we've had any case that involved the division of hearing and appeals, because it doesn't cover all of the agencies. It does cover the Department of Transportation.
If Your Honor would like, I'd be happy to provide a written letter or material on that issue.
Thank you.
I didn't anticipate.
No, I know. And had I anticipated it earlier, I might have asked the Court to send you a letter asking you to describe it. So I won't press it again, but that's still my problem, a problem.
But I think Your Honor makes a very good point with respect to the division versus the trial court, that they're both fulfilling the same function. And there's the reason for deferring, and my understanding of the policy of this Court in deferring, is that in some cases when an agency is handling a routine matter that it has handled many times before, and it's got a track record, and it involves some technical expertise, the Court defers. The Court defers because it has not had as many cases, as much experience interpreting that. That's not true in this case.
Counsel, your experience outruns mine on the division. This is a summary judgment, right?
Correct. It was a drastic decision.
Yeah. Is summary judgments usual in the division?
I cannot answer that question because I'm not familiar with the division's practice across cases. I will say in this case, we are not asking the Court to determine that Harley-Davidson violated the dealer agreement or that Harley-Davidson's actions violated 218.0116 of 8. The only thing we say is that we have a right to an evidentiary hearing to determine whether there's good cause to permit changes to a contract.
And that goes back to another point. It seems to me the two parties are arguing intent, what documents were intended to be part of the contract. And that may be a factual issue. Are you arguing that?
Intent would be a factual issue. However, that is not our primary argument, nor do I think it should be the argument that this Court jumps to primarily. First of all, let's just say that even if the parties intended it, let's say Harley-Davidson came to the table in 1994 and said, we're not putting your territory in the contract. We'd have a hard time establishing that the intent with respect to the territory being part of the contract. But it's irrelevant what Harley-Davidson's intent was with respect to taking the territory out. The contract cannot exist without the description of the territory being in that contract. All of the rights and obligations of the parties are specifically tied to the description of the territory. It's incomplete without it.
I have another question for you. The territorial provision says that Harley-Davidson has to exercise good faith.
Right.
So even if you lose at the administrative level like this because they're in effect saying they have no jurisdiction over it because it's not part of the agreement, right? Why don't you just go into trial court and get the trial court to determine what's good faith?
There are two reasons, first of all. Good faith implies us to determine Harley-Davidson's intent. That's an incredible burden on a dealer to walk into a case and have to prove that the manufacturer had bad intent. Was bad faith in doing what they did. Okay. However, the legislature specifically did not use a good faith standard with respect to contract modifications for dealers and manufacturers. It used the term good cause. And what's the difference? Good cause is a neutral factor. It's a neutral factor based on facts from both sides, and you don't have to figure out what somebody's reasoning was for doing something. Good faith, and I will say this last point, good faith is only in that contract as long as Harley-Davidson wants it to be. They took out the territory and put in a good faith provision. What's to stop them next year from just taking out the good faith provision? The dealer has no control over it.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Attorney Butler.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Brian Butler, and I represent the Wisconsin Automobile and Truck Dealers Association. I'm going to ask three questions and suggest answers to those questions. The first is whether Section 218.0116 sub 8, which I will call sub 8 for short, should it be preserved? The second question is, does the Court of Appeals decision threaten the existence of sub 8? And the third question is, how should this Court rescue sub 8? To the first question, should sub 8 be preserved? This is a commonsensical statute. It recognizes that automobile manufacturers have to be able to modify their arrangements with their dealers because of the competitive conditions they face in the marketplace, and it permits them to do that. But it also recognizes that dealers should be able to protest changes in the business arrangement if those changes substantially and adversely affect their rights, obligations, investment, or return on investment, in the words of the statute. So, to the second question, does the Court of Appeals decision threaten the existence of Rule 8? It does, because it invites manufacturers to draft contracts to exclude essential terms of the relationship from the contract. Essential terms addressing what facilities the dealer has to have, addressing the inventory requirements the dealer must meet, what kind of personnel the dealer must have, what marketing methods the dealer must follow, what market share the dealer must achieve. If all of those are outside of the contract because the dealer hires a good lawyer like Mr. Stone who drafts it that way, then, of course, changes can be made with respect to all those essential terms and they won't be subject to review under sub 8.
Mr. Butler, if I can interrupt you at this point, what's your position in terms of what is the contract here? Are you telling us that there are three separate documents that make up the contract?
My position is different from Racine Harley-Davidson's, but it doesn't matter because we both reach the same result. I think that the question of what is the contract is a matter strictly of what the statute says. The statute says the contract is the franchise relationship. And so that can mean implied agreements. That can mean oral agreements. The relationship encompasses the business arrangement between the parties. That's the contract, as I see it.
So another way of saying that would be all three documents would be the contract?
Absolutely. At minimum. And, well, as I was saying, to finish my second point, the invitation that the Court of Appeals extends to clever draftspeople for the manufacturers is probably an invitation that the manufacturers will accept. Harley-Davidson, incidentally, does not respond to the threat. It does not discuss this threat that I'm raising in its brief. Now, my third question, which is how should this Court rescue Rule 8? And I really already answered that, which is by reading the definition of agreement in the statute in 218.0101 sub 1, which I'll call sub 1, what it says. It says that it's the agreement is a contract that describes the franchise relationship. Franchise relationship is a broad term. It encompasses how the parties conduct themselves in relation to each other in the real life of the business world. As I say it, I think it encompasses unwritten as well as written rules. This is the approach the Court took in the Ziegler case when faced with the question of what is the agreement under Chapter 135 of Fair Dealership Law that is encompassed, that is protected by that statute.
Mr. Butler, if I can pin you down, because you've argued now a couple of times that agreement is the franchise relationship, and as I see the statute, it says agreement means a contract that describes the franchise relationship. So don't we have to determine, this is to follow up Justice Crook's question, what constitutes the contract that describes this relationship?
No. No. I think that language is best understood by just turning it around and saying that the relationship is the contract. The relationship is the agreement.
Doesn't that render
the
word surplusage then? No,
I don't think so. It's just a broader understanding of the notion of contract, that it is not limited by what the parties have chosen, what one party, because it's the one party who chooses to put in writing whatever it chooses to put in writing. It doesn't artificially restrict the notion of contract in that fashion. It says it's the relationship. I think it's appropriate to call the entirety of the business relationship a contract.
Now,
that's what the statute says. It's a contract that describes the relationship.
If you had a contract and it leaves out a significant term like price,
yes,
or maybe time can be of the essence and it leaves out time, this contract or this agreement that Harley Davidson relies on leaves out an essential element. I always thought the market area of the franchise was an essential element of these contracts, unless you're talking about the entire world.
The marketing area? Yes, it is an essential element. Now, that isn't to say that the dealers can't sell outside of the area they're assigned. They can, but the area has enormous significance to the parties because in the automobile industry, it's used initially to calculate what's called the dealer's planning volume, which in turn drives the size of the facility that the dealer has to build. If the area is subsequently reduced and the dealer is left with an oversized facility. It's an important part of determining the dealer's sales goals, what are the characteristics of the area the dealer is assigned, the characteristics of the population, the demographics. Dealers, automobile dealers, are typically evaluated by the manufacturer both in terms of their sales and the registrations of automobiles that take place in their areas of sales responsibility, whether they sell them or not. But in either case, if the dealer is assigned an area that is partly more convenient to another dealer, that skews the result and affects the dealer's evaluation. Well, termination can result if
how do you modify these? How do you? Here we had a move from Kenosha to supposedly closer to Burlington. How do you modify? Are these agreements set in stone?
Well, the point of the statute, I think, is the agreements typically give the manufacturer the right to make those judgments. But the purpose of the statute is that if the move of another dealer into the territory constitutes a change in the relationship, then the dealer has a right to challenge it and determine. There are six or seven factors that the tribunal looks at to decide whether it's an appropriate change or not. So that is really the what I have to say to the court. Thank you.
I have a question because I hesitate to transpose the sentence and say that the relationship is the contract. Seems awfully amorphous in some situations. Relationship regarding what? Relationship between whom? I mean, how do I... Relationship for how long? Maybe the relationship has changed. Maybe it's a new relationship. Maybe it's been existence. Maybe the father gave the business to the daughter and son. And so it just seems it's hard to get a hold of. Can you respond to that?
Well, the language of the statute is franchise relationship. It's a contract that describes the franchise relationship. And that is the business relationship. And there may be a question at some point whether a particular agreement is or is not part of that relationship, a particular duty or a particular obligation. But I think it's an academic, it's a problem of academic interest only, because only if the dealer can show that the change with respect to that duty or obligation substantially adversely affects the dealer will it ever become an issue. So if someone's changing a zip code somewhere and the question is that part of the contract or not, no one's ever going to raise the issue unless, as in this case, it deprives Racine Harley-Davidson of a substantial portion of its market.
Thank you, Mr. Butler.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Stone, representing Harley-Davidson.
Good morning. Just about. May it please the Court, my name is Peter Stone, and I represent Harley-Davidson Motor Company in this case. And there has been a great deal of discussion in the briefs and here this morning about the standard of review that's appropriate in this case. But I would submit that this is one of those cases where the outcome really isn't determinative of what standard of review you decide to apply. This is a case where the Division of Hearing and Appeals was asked to answer a relatively straightforward question. They did it applying the expertise they've developed over the years in interpreting and ruling on cases under Chapter 218. They did it in the context of the specific Harley-Davidson Motor Company dealer contract that was at issue. They did it in the context of the Harley-Davidson policies on territories were at issue. And they made a relatively straightforward decision that the assignment of a territory to Racine was not part of its motor vehicle dealer agreement, and that therefore under 218 sub 8, I'll refer to it that way as well, there was no right to object to a modification of that particular territory.
Counselor, if that's the case and Racine Harley-Davidson was doing a punky job of selling motorcycles and Harley-Davidson was unhappy with their work under the contract, how could they ever enforce an expectation to sell a certain number of vehicles, which I'm sure they must do, as most manufacturers do? So if you don't know the area, how can you say there's an expectation to sell 100 vehicles, 300 vehicles, 700 vehicles? Isn't that dependent on knowing the area?
Yes, and Harley-Davidson had an obligation under the dealer contract to assign every dealer a territory. That's very specific in the contract, and in fact, in Wisconsin, there's a statutory requirement that a territory be assigned, and there's no dispute in this case that a territory was assigned. However, neither the dealer contract or Chapter 218 require that the designation of a specific territory be part of the motor vehicle dealer agreement.
But how can you enforce the agreement against Racine Harley-Davidson? Okay? I mean, the manufacturer's got an expectation, just say, 300 motorcycles in 6 months. I have no idea if that's anywhere near what they do. And they don't meet this expectation. And so Harley-Davidson is unhappy, and they want to enforce the agreement against them. How can they do it without having the territory be a part of that agreement?
Simply because a dealer has an obligation to perform certain things within a territory doesn't make the particular designation of that territory itself part of the agreement. The contract gives Harley-Davidson the right to assign the territory and obligates the dealer to perform within that territory that is assigned. But that territory is something that's subject to change from time to time. And in fact, in the real world here, these territories change more than 1,000 times a year, the record reflects. Harley-Davidson assigns zip codes to comprise the dealer's territory, and they do it on a relatively straightforward basis. They assign the zip code to the nearest dealer. Dealers are relocating all of the time, for example, and that's what happened here. The dealer in Kenosha relocated. His new location was closer to the centroid, or the central point of this Burlington zip code, which was one of 18 or 20 that were assigned to the Racine dealer. And under Harley-Davidson's uniformly enforced policy, it says when that happens, the zip code gets reassigned to the closest dealer. This isn't something that benefits Harley-Davidson. This is a situation that benefits all of the dealers.
But then
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just want to follow up because I'm still not sure I understand. So then if I understand what you're saying, if they change then the territory, then do they also send out a change in expectations of what that dealer that now has lost territory is to provide, or the dealer that's gained territory is to provide?
If a dealer's territory changes, the dealer is notified of that. In this particular case, Racine was notified that because of the relocation, Burlington was no longer going to be part of its territory.
Right.
And then to the extent, on a going forward basis, Harley-Davidson evaluated the dealer's performance within a territory, it would evaluate it based upon that lesser territory, actually. To that extent, the switch benefited Racine and lowered expectations within a smaller territory.
Okay, so everything about performance then is tied to some degree to the territory, because if the territory gets smaller, they're expected to perform differently, and if the territory gets larger, they're expected to perform more expansively.
No, actually not. I mean, it's not really a record in this case because this isn't a performance case, but Harley-Davidson doesn't establish quotas for its dealers.
Okay, all right. Okay, thank you.
If I could, I understand the legal arguments. What I'm trying to understand is the practical effect of any ruling this court might issue would have on the parties. So if this court were to disagree with your position and construe agreement broadly to include the territorial designations, so that sub 8, as has been referred to, kicks in, how is Harley-Davidson harmed?
What it would mean that every time a territory changes, hundreds, thousands of times a year, some subset of that in Wisconsin, when a dealer relocates or new dealers established or the post office changes the zip code, every time that happens,
A dealer would have the right to file a formal protest with the Divisions of Hearing and Appeals, and there would have to be a hearing on whether the change had a substantial adverse impact upon the dealer and whether or not there was good cause for the change. And that would obviously have a very significant impact. And that wasn't what the contemplation of the parties was. The contract very specifically doesn't include the designation of the territory. And the reason it doesn't is because territories change so frequently, and it's necessary for Harley-Davidson to be able to make those changes for the benefit of all of its dealers so that territories are consistent. If you didn't change the assignment of the zip codes to the nearest dealers when dealers moved or new dealers were established, pretty soon you'd have an absolute mess and territories would be meaningless, and that would harm all of the dealers.
Counsel, how can you have Rule 8, which was referred to by opposing counsel, what I'm having trouble just understanding, if this is a unilateral decision on Harley's part, so no. It is not.
It's a decision that's made in accordance with a Harley-Davidson policy that's been in place since 1994 and sent to all of the dealers. Okay. And it's automatic. When the dealer moves, the company automatically looks at the zip code assignments by geography, and they're reassigned.
Okay. Just forgive me for a minute because I'm just trying to imagine when you say a dealer moves. Now, obviously, the dealer from Kenosha, I can't imagine him simply moving his business without letting Harley know. I mean, in other words, you have control over how many dealers you're going to have. I understand that, and that's probably good business practice. But where they move to, and if they affect another dealer, you're saying that's not unilateral. That's something they can negotiate.
If a dealer is approved for a specific location in the dealer contract, if a dealer wants to relocate, which Yukes Harley-Davidson in Kenosha did, he has to ask Harley-Davidson for permission to do that. However, the contract provides that Harley-Davidson can't unreasonably refuse to approve, and if the company refused to approve, that also be sued under Chapter 218 for violating various provisions. So while, yes, it's Harley-Davidson's decision, it's certainly not unrestricted.
Well, I guess what I'm imagining, if you move and you cut Racine's territory in half, and they had, I'm going to make this up, they had all this investment, big building, 50 employees, and all of a sudden, your expectations are less, but their expectations are really, say, we've got to cut back here because we don't have the territory anymore. Am I explained it correctly? In other words, you said you go by zip code. So if you had 10,000 zip codes and now you have 5,000, your expectations are not only cut, but your ability to operate as a business is also affected, right?
Well, dealers have various protections regarding encroachment on their territory, both in the dealer contract and under Chapter 218.
That was the reason for 218.
Yes. Yeah, for example, a dealer can't relocate into someone else's territory. They can only relocate within their own territory, and that's what Yukes did.
Yukes went into Racine's territory.
No, Yukes moved from downtown Kenosha out to along I-94, a location that was within its assigned territory. But what happened was, because it moved to the west,
right,
it was closer to Burlington, and it now became closer to the centroid of that zip code than was the Racine dealership. And just like every time a dealer moves, Harley looks at the map, uses computer software to generate, you know, driving distances and figures out who is closest to that zip code, and then it gets assigned to the closest dealer. And zip codes are changing all the time, and dealers lose them, but they gain them, too, when people move. Every zip code in the country is assigned to someone.
Well, the argument, and I was just looking, that the dealer contract anticipates the assignment of territory, which is apart from the contract, so that this is something that's outside of the contract, this move. In other words, is this something that always has to be negotiated or never is negotiated?
A dealer's move?
Yes. And the change that took place here, just so I understand.
It happens when a dealer makes a request. Requests can be generated by the dealer, who on his own may decide he needs a bigger facility or wants a more convenient location. Moves may be suggested by Harley-Davidson for various reasons, if it feels the facility is too small. But initially, then it has to come from the dealer to Harley-Davidson, who evaluates the request, approves or disapproves it within the framework of having to make a reasonable decision, both contractually and statutorily.
So did Kenosha lose any zip codes when it moved?
I don't remember offhand if they did or they didn't. They very well may have.
But it's also possible they just gained.
May have, because if they move directly west, there's no other dealership to the east of them because of Lake Michigan.
Yeah, right. Well, that's right. Okay. Yeah, so all dealers are at the same size. I mean, I'm speaking from not knowing, but I assume that you have bigger dealers and smaller dealers. And the issue here is whether or not this move took away, and we'll forget about the decisions, but basically took away some of the business of Racine. And gave it to somebody else.
Size of a dealership can be measured a lot of different ways. For example, by the number of new motorcycles that a dealer sells. The relocation of Ukes and the loss of the one zip code by Racine did not affect its allocation and the number of motorcycles it got. Size can be measured by the size of a dealership's facility. Obviously, the loss of a zip code had no impact upon that facility. Size can be measured, I suppose, by territory, but territory is very widely on a geographic scope. I mean, out in the western part of the U.S., where there are much fewer dealers, dealers will have territories comprised of hundreds of miles in either direction. In more, centralized municipal kind of locations, the territories are much smaller.
And I can go from Madison to any dealer in the state just so I can buy a motorcycle.
Absolutely. Dealers are able to sell to anyone located everywhere. The territories are non-exclusive. There's no restriction on where they can sell or to whom they can sell or where or how they can advertise.
So what's the point of the territory?
Territories do a couple of things. They are used to help determine which dealers Harley-Davidson will assist with respect to direct mail. Dealers who want to relocate or open up a second facility can only do so within their assigned territory, so it can potentially affect where a business might ultimately be located. But it doesn't affect a dealer's ability to sell or advertise or to whom they can sell. That all gets to the question of whether there will be a substantial adverse impact from a change, and of course that's an issue we haven't gotten to in this case and that Harley-Davidson thinks we don't need to get to. There's no doubt that the court has the authority to construe contracts. That's a question of law. There's no doubt that the court has the authority to construe statutes. That's a question of law that appellate courts do all of the time. However, when the decision that an appellate court is reviewing is from an agency, there has been a whole lot of doctrine, body of case law that's grown up that says the court should or could give some deference to the agency decision depending upon a number of factors. Now, while I'm much older than Ms. Zylstra, I also don't have a real good handle on what the Department of Transportation may have done before the division was created.
Counselor, I have a question for you about the standard of review. You know, this is a court that takes cases only because they choose to. Why should we ever defer to an agency when we take a question that we think is important?
Well, I think some deference should be given, including in this case where the agency has brought some of its expertise to bear, and I think that's what happened here. This isn't just a question of abstract contract construction. It's not just a question of construing a statute in the abstract. It's looking at a contract in the context of the motor vehicle dealer relationship. It's looking at three or four different provisions of a statute, a scheme that this agency is charged with supervising and enhancing. And they have a lot of experience deciding these kinds of cases. Judge Kaiser, as Ms. Zylstra mentioned, if you do a search of cases, he's decided many, many cases under Chapter 218 over the years. So I think I would submit he has both.
What about under Sub 8 and Sub 1?
There have been other cases decided under Section 216, Sub 8, but not under this particular provision. I mean, we have conceded and don't argue that there is no decision on the question of whether a term that is not part of the contract is nevertheless subject to challenge under Sub 8 as a modification of the motor vehicle dealer agreement.
If it's not under the contract, why is it binding on you?
Well, we have a binding contractual obligation to assign a territory, and we have a statutory obligation to assign a territory.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done that. If we failed to do that, we'd be in breach of contract in violation of the statute. Once we make the assignment, mm-hmm. We can only change it in our good faith business judgment. And if there's not a good
faith, under the agreement.
Under the agreement. And if there's not a good faith business reason to do that, we can be challenged on it. But there's nothing in Chapter 218.
Doesn't it sound like a contract to you?
No. The designation of the territory itself is not part of the contract.
Yes, it is. You're bound by it, and they're bound by it. That is a contract. Now, maybe there are three contracts in this case, or two contracts in the case, and maybe one of those contracts doesn't fit under agreement, but it is a contract. If you don't act in good faith, you're going to be liable for breach of that term, right?
Yes, I agree
with that. Sounds like a contract to me. The issue is whether it's part of the phrase agreement in the statute. An agreement says contract, but it doesn't end there. It doesn't say an agreement is a contract. There's a comma, and it says that governs a
franchise
relationship. I don't know if it should be comma which or comma that. I didn't look that up. And that whether or not it's a clause that limits the word contract or just describes the contract. You have any help for me grammatically or otherwise?
I'll try. Let me just come back to your first point.
Mm-hmm.
While a territory designation is in effect, while the Burlington zip code was part of Racine's territory, we did have an obligation, and the dealer had an obligation with respect to that territory. However, it's the ability to change that territory, which is at issue here, and the designation of the territory itself is not part of the contract. Now, if you look at sub 8, it's motor vehicle dealer agreement is the phrase that's used. It doesn't use the term contract there. It says we can't modify a motor vehicle dealer agreement. And then if you look at the definition of agreement, it says it means a contract, not the franchise relationship. It means a contract that describes the franchise relationship. And actually, if you look at sub 13, the word franchise is also defined in the statute. It means the right to buy, sell, or distribute.
Right. So it's
actually means something. There was really no dispute between Harley-Davidson and Racine in this case as it came up from the division to the circuit court to the court of appeals, that the contract between the parties was the motorcycle dealer contract that's attached to the appendix. It is a very comprehensive document that describes the franchise relationship between the parties. What Racine has attempted to do is argue essentially that despite the language of the contract, the specific territory should be an implied term or an additional term to that contract.
Maybe it's incorporated by reference. The franchise agreement does mention territory.
Absolutely.
And as you said, it's required by the statute that you assign a territory. So why isn't it incorporated by reference?
The dealer contract is a two-part document. It's a signature document, and then there are general conditions of sales and service. If you look at page 2 of the signature document, paragraph 2, it refers to the general conditions and says they are expressly made a part of this contract and incorporated herein. So there's no doubt that the second part of this, the general conditions, are incorporated. There's absolutely no language anywhere that makes that kind of reference with respect to territory. In fact, paragraph 1 of the signature document simply says that a territory will be assigned under the contract. And under the contract means by authority of the contract. Doesn't mean as a part of or in this contract. Territory is not specified in the contract, in any attachment, or in any addendum.
Mr. Stone, if I could, I want to follow right up on that point, because you referred now a number of times to the contract, the contract, the contract. 218.01.01, sub 1, refers to agreement meaning, and maybe, forgive me for being a bit Clinton-esque here, but a contract, not the contract. It's a contract that describes the franchise relationship. So I guess in interpreting this statute, are we to look at every contract that describes this franchise relationship or just the contract that you focused on? And isn't that a question of statutory interpretation?
That is a question of statutory interpretation in part, but in the context of what the party's relationship here is. And I would submit it doesn't make any difference whether you say the or a, because there is only one contract here.
I thought you've already agreed that there were two. There's the sales agreement and that there's the contract itself. And I thought the issue was the third document that dealt with the territorial claims. Am I wrong?
If I said that I misspoke, I apologize. There is a single dealer contract. It is composed of two documents. One is the signature document, which is only 3 or 4 pages. The rest of it is described as the general conditions of sales and service, which is expressly and very specifically incorporated into the dealer contract. So there is only a dealer contract here, only one agreement. There is no agreement with Racine about territory. There's never any document that says we agree with them that your territory will be these 20 zip codes, including the Burlington zip code. All there is an agreement that we have a right and an obligation to assign a territory, but that territory won't be specified in the dealer contract because it's going to be subject to change all of the time for various reasons. Okay.
Mr. Stone, if I might, one of the things that gives me some concern here is the fact that the agency handled this through summary judgment. And I'm looking at good cause, good faith. Those are terms that come from the statute and from the contract. How can this be handled through a summary judgment procedure? Isn't there a need to take testimony and to determine whether there was good faith, good cause involved here?
Neither of those terms were at issue before the division. The good faith reference you make is to the contractual requirement that Harley can only change territory in the exercise of its good faith business judgment. Right. The division doesn't have authority to consider contract disputes. A breach of contract claim wasn't filed with them, and no separate civil action has been filed for breach of contract. The good cause requirement you're referring to is in Section 218.116, sub 8 of the statute, but you get to that only if you get by the first issue, which is the territory change a modification of the motor vehicle dealer agreement? And that was the sole issue that Harley-Davidson moved for summary judgment on. It's a preliminary issue, but it's a dispositive one. And because the territory isn't part of the agreement, you don't have to get to the question of good cause.
When Harley-Davidson went to the zip codes, was there any dispute at that time, really anywhere in the country, that going from zip codes to whatever they had before was a change in the contract?
Again, that information isn't in the record. I can tell you what my understanding is if you'd like. It was a decision that was made by Harley-Davidson in consultation with its dealer network. There was an internal arbitration process set up that if dealers had questions about how zip codes have been allocated, they could bring those to the company through arbitration. And I think during those first initial years, there was a lot of sorting out of how a zip code should be assigned to one dealer or another, and that was worked through. But since that time, the dealers have pretty uniformly accepted the system because it benefits them. Doesn't impact Harley that much one way or the other, except that we want a territory system that has integrity and has meaning to it. But all of the dealers benefit from being assigned zip codes that are closest to them, including when they relocate or if a new dealer comes into the area, or when the post office changes zip codes, as they do frequently. So there's a pretty well-established history of this policy working now since then.
Well, the real question I have in my mind is, suppose Justice Bradley has a dealership and I have a dealership. Does this zip code scheme really permit me to manipulate the size of my or the value of my territory by moving one way or the other to the disadvantage of Justice Bradley?
No. Your initial location when you become a dealer is approved by Harley-Davidson based typically upon a study of the market as to what most appropriate locations are. Once you're established in a dealership and Justice Bradley is established in her dealership, if you're neighboring dealerships, You'll each have zip codes assigned to you. You may have some, you will have what we refer to as some border zip codes where, you know, your zip codes border hers. And those are the ones typically that might be subject to reassignment if either of you decide to move your dealership facility with Harley-Davidson's approval to do that. We can't tell dealers they can never move because the markets change, populations move. There's all sorts of reasons why dealerships need to move, including growth in the dealership as well. So we have to allow that.
Counsel, if I may.
Yeah, to your question, I'm not sure.
Well, suppose you like me better. I mean, could
you're in big trouble.
I mean, could there be some collusion between Harley and a particular dealership? I mean, the more willing Harley is to permit movement, or maybe a second dealership within the territory, the more likely it is, it seems to me, that one dealer could affect another.
Well, if somehow Harley were in collusion with another dealer and had acted inappropriately in approving one dealer's move and zip codes got reassigned because of it, that clearly wouldn't be in the good faith business judgment of the company, and you certainly would have contractual grounds to attack that. The statute, by the way, the same statute that requires Harley-Davidson to assign a territory also talks about a particular instance in which manufacturers are prohibited from modifying or changing territories, and that's if they want to get around the requirement that they have to give notice to a dealer if they want to establish another dealership in that dealer's territory. For example, if you had a dealership and Harley was thinking about establishing a new dealership within your territory, but before it did that, it took away one of your zip codes and gave it to someone else so that it could go ahead and do that, it'd be prohibited by statute from doing that. But that's not an issue in this case here either. There's no allegation that Harley did anything like that. In fact, there's no allegation that anything happened here other than Harley-Davidson followed their longstanding non-discriminatory policy on assigning zip codes to the nearest dealers.
Counsel, I want to follow up. My Harley franchise is in Schofield, Wisconsin, 54476. It's Schofield is next to Wausau. Wausau is the major metropolitan area of the area. Okay, but I'm in Schofield. Wausau is a different zip, 54403. There's another Harley-Davidson dealership in Mosinee.
I think I have the geography.
Okay. Zip code. I can't remember Mosinee. And
no,
but part of that, it wasn't Mosinee. You know, Mosinee is a small town. But part of that area comes to Rib Mountain, 54401. Okay. Now, the reason I say this is really the action in terms of the number of people, at least in my hypothetical, is Wausau. But now that they've come to Rib Mountain, they're closer to downtown Wausau than the 54476 Schofield is. It seems to me that, now here I am, I'm in Schofield, I've got this lovely and large, right on the river, right on the lake in fact, dealership, but now, boy, they've taken over my Wausau market. What do I do? Isn't that a problem given the, what I understand to be the purpose and intent of Chapter 218?
Well, Chapter 218 does provide protection to dealers by defining relevant market area for them. It's a radius of 10 miles from your dealership or the territory that's assigned to you already by the manufacturer, whichever is greater. So no other dealer can encroach within 10 miles of you or into your assigned territory, so you have that protection. So if it's the Mosinee dealer that was moving to Rib Mountain?
Yeah, that's okay. Right. You know, they're close.
For that to happen...
But Rib Mountain is right next to Wausau.
For that to happen, Rib Mountain would already have to be in the territory of the Mosinee dealer. Yeah. It couldn't be in your territory or the Wausau dealer's territory.
Yeah, in my hypothetical it is. Okay. And the geography would work that way. But that means then, and it may be closer to the, you know, the post office... downtown in Wausau, and so they take over the Wausau?
No, the dealer in Wausau would obviously still be closer to that Wausau zip code.
Maybe. The problem is that there's no dealer in Wausau, it's just Schofield.
Okay.
Anyway, okay. I don't want to mix things up, but my point is that perhaps following all the rules, you can take over the major metropolitan market because you've moved closer to them, and then poor Schofield gets left behind in the dust. And obviously everybody likes Burlington for some reason.
The Burlington Greater Lake Geneva area is an area that has been of interest to a number of Harley-Davidson dealers who have looked at opening additional stores in that area, and the company has done a number of market studies of that area to determine what's best. But certainly the Racine dealer does continue to sell in Burlington. He's free to continue to sell in Burlington, as is the dealer in Milwaukee and the dealer in Kenosha and the dealer in Northern Illinois.
Why is he hurt?
Why is the Racine dealer hurt?
If you can can he advertise in Burlington?
Yes.
Can he mail letters into the Burlington zip code?
Yes.
So why is he hurt? Why is the Racine dealer hurt if the zip code is taken out of its territory?
Again, that's an issue that we don't get to at this point. But our position would be that he's not substantially adversely impacted, and to the extent there is any impact to him, it would be counterbalanced by the great need of Harley-Davidson to operate this kind of fair system. He loses some financial support in connection with the direct mailing. He's free to mail, but he doesn't get a little bit of subsidy from Harley-Davidson that he would otherwise get.
In other words, for competitive reasons, he could mail a brochure in the entire state of Wisconsin saying, we've got the best price on the Sportster, come down. And,
yes. You know, what Harley-Davidson really regulates is the location from which a dealer can sell. He can sell to someone from California if that person from California comes to the dealership to buy the motorcycle.
Can he ship to California through the web?
No, for various reasons. Probably be a violation of California's motor vehicle dealer law for an unlicensed dealership into California.
It's an interstate commerce. Can he ship anywhere in Wisconsin?
Can he ship anywhere in Wisconsin? The dealer contract requires that the motorcycle be sold at the dealership facility.
And ship.
Set up, inspected, and delivered there.
Okay.
So he can't drop ship around the state. And there's a lot of safety and warranty reasons to have the bike delivered in person to the customer.
Okay.
Could Racine mail to Burlington and describe itself as your Harley dealership, local Harley dealership?
Well, I don't see why not. That term is subject to interpretation, I guess, and some ambiguity, but he wants to be their dealership. He's going to sell in the market. He wants to service products that are there. He's certainly free to do that from his location in Racine, just like he had been previously when Burlington was assigned to him.
Thank you, Mr. Stone.
Thank you.
Ms. Silvestri, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Why do you care about Burlington?
Why does everyone care about Burlington? Burlington was the second highest in sales for my client, for Racine. But more importantly, to put it into a broader perspective besides just profitability, there are several reasons. The first is Racine loses product. And this is an important factor with respect to Harley-Davidson because dealers want more than they can get from Harley to sell. Our client in particular made a request for more product in 94 and was told that it was already receiving enough product for its market potential. So you take away territory and Racine gets even less product than it has now to sell, which affects...
Well, that was in 94. Now that's 99. You've got a different contract. And what difference does it make other than what you're saying is that if you're in an assigned area and you sell 100 motorcycles and you want 110, you can only get 100, right? In other words, you can only, if you're in an area, you just said that you only get so many. You can sell more than you get. That's what I thought you were saying.
Correct. The demand right now is higher than supply.
But you can sell any place in the state. I mean, I'm just, opposing counsel indicated that you can advertise any place in the state, maybe with your own money,
correct,
not so much with Harley's.
Correct. There are several other, and I was about to expound on why territory matters and what we lose. First of all, dealers have a right, as Mr. Stone talked about, to open a secondary location if it's within their territory, if they get Harley's permission. At the time that they took Burlington, Racine had a request, an application, at Harley-Davidson to open a second location in Burlington. By taking Burlington, it was effectively a denial of its request to open a secondary location in Burlington. The second a very important right that Racine has just lost is the ability to protest another dealer moving into the Burlington area. When Burlington was part of its zip code or part of its territory, if Justice Bradley decided that she wanted to open a dealership in Burlington, guess what? I can protest that. Racine can protest that because you're now in my territory. By taking Burlington, Racine lost that right to protest. The other reasons is the direct mail and the website leads. Right now, Mr. Stone referred to it as, quote, a little bit of money. Well, most people don't think of money as a little bit, depending on the circumstances. Right now, there is direct mail that goes into the territory. They go into the Burlington zip codes that Harley-Davidson helps pay for, that advertises Racine, or at least it did before Burlington was taken away. They went directly to people in Burlington that advertised Racine as their dealer. Harley-Davidson helped pay for that, no longer paying for that because Burlington was taken from Racine. The second thing is websites leads. Harley-Davidson gets leads from people who are interested across the country in their motorcycles. They forward those leads to the dealer who has that territory. So all of the Burlington leads will no longer go to Racine. They'll go to Ukes, the Kenosha dealer. I wanted to take a chance to address a few other points that Mr. Stone made, and in particular correct slightly some of the factual issues. Mr. Stone suggested that there are 1,000 times a year zip codes change, and the record reflects that. That's not quite accurate. The record reflects only Harley put in an affidavit that said zip code reassignments under this policy are frequent and routine. There was no discussion of numbers below. But regardless, even if they had put in that information, there's a couple reasons why that's not really true. In essence, first of all, think about it. If zip code reassignments were that frequent and that common and that routine, we'd have more protests from the dealers. The dealer protest laws have been on the books for years. This is the first time the division's considered this issue. Now, that being said, the other problem that I have is Harley-Davidson suggests that this assignment occurred under its, quote, uniform policy. It was non-discriminatory. That's a factual dispute that we have hotly disputed. We put in the record on summary judgment. Excuse me. Our expert report says that they didn't measure the distance correctly. If you measure the distance under their, quote, uniform policy, Burlington would have never been taken from Racine. This factual dispute is not really up neither here nor there for this court because that comes under the good cause finding. We don't believe there was good cause to do this in part because they're not even following their own policy. I would like to address Justice Butler's comments that he asked of Mr. Stone, and he suggested that every time there's a contract modification, a dealer would have a right to protest, and the division would be constantly deciding these disputes. That's not true, and there's several reasons. One is, first, at the end of the day, Racine is going to have an ongoing contractual relationship with Harley-Davidson. That ongoing contractual relationship is going to mean that you are only going to protest when it really matters to you. When it comes down to it, it's when you're gutting my territory that I've got to stand up and say something. Other minor modifications, we are not going to protest because we've still got to work with these people. The second reason is that it's expensive. This litigation in and of itself is extremely expensive. No dealer is going to undertake expensive litigation to fight something minor that it doesn't care about. And, of course, the statute requires any change, contract modification, to substantially and adversely affect the rights of the dealer and the dealer's investments. That's a high burden. Substantial and adverse effect is something that Racine will have to prove. All of those things in combination mean that these disputes will not be taking up the division's time on a day-to-day basis.
Thank you, Ms. Zylstra, and thank you, Mr. Stone. I do want to raise one issue to put it on the record. Several weeks or nights ago, on a dark, rainy night in Madison at the Dane County Regional Airport, Attorney Lazard offered me a ride, with Mr. Butler being the driver. The ride took me from the airport terminal to the surface lot. I accepted it gratefully and offered to pay Mr. Butler for any costs involved in this mechanical device, which neither he nor I operated very well. And he was to send me a bill. I have not gotten a bill. Mr. Butler, is there any charge that you were subject to? Pardon me? Oh, no, but did you pay that little machine?
Oh, for you?
Yes.
Oh, no.
Good, okay. I just wanted the record to be perfectly clear on this, and I owed you nothing but thanks, which I am happy publicly to acknowledge. And I'll take a ride again like that if you offer. That closes the argument on 2003 AP 2628, Racine Harley Davidson versus State of Wisconsin Division of Hearings and Appeal. Thank you to all the counsel. We are in recess until 1:30.
Thank you.